Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking about life in the driftless area of Wisconsin and Minnesota, as a matter of fact, with Reggie McLeod. He's the editor and publisher of Big River Magazine. And as we talk with him, hope you'll join in. What interests you in the area's history? Do you have questions about the Mississippi River? I hope you'll give a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you can email us to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Reggie McLeod, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Good morning, Larry. It's good to be back.
We get lots of calls on Garden Talk about Prairie Moon Nursery. A lot of people recommend Prairie Moon Nursery. And you've got a great story in the latest issue of your magazine. Tell us about the company.
Sure. Well, it's kind of interesting. They're a local company here near Winona, Minnesota. And they started, really got started back in the 70s, actually, and have grown to be pretty large and have a lot of influence. And I think they got started before people really were broadly interested in native plants and restoring prairies and that sort of thing. So they've kind of grown right with the interest in it, which is great. And yeah, it's a fascinating place. They have collected a lot of wild seeds. They grow different varieties of hundreds and hundreds of different plants, not just prairie plants, but also woodland plants. I was on a tour one time. I have a number of friends who work there, so I've kind of seen it personally grow up over the years. And one time I was with one of them in the woods near his home there in the community farm. And he was showing me all these woodland plants that I thought I was familiar with. But he'd show me one, and then he'd show me like five or six different varieties of it and then point out the differences between these. And I was kind of overwhelmed. After a while, I looked at that woods, and I saw 10 times as many things as I had seen before, you know, the plants in that. So
yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah,
and it was just a couple of people, a husband and wife, if I'm trying to remember now exactly. It's been a bit since I read the story, but that started the thing.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, Alan's folks had been working with prairie plants for a long time. His mother had actually started a business, which basically evolved into Prairie Moon Nursery, and his father had studied with Leo
Aldo Leopold.
Aldo Leopold. I'm sorry, I got his name backwards there. Aldo Leopold at University of Wisconsin when he was in graduate school. And so the couple, Yaro and Alan, kind of was helping out Alan's mom and then brought the business to the community farm, and it grew from there. And actually, Yaro worked here at Big River Magazine for about 10 years, too.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, and another guy who worked here went to work at Prairie Moon after he worked here. So we've had a little bit of overlap there.
A little back and forth. And, you know, they went from those, you know, a couple of people to they employ a lot of people now. Summertime, I think it was somewhere around 70 people.
Oh, it's about 40 in the summer.
Oh, 40, sorry.
Yeah, but they have a lot of contractors, too. They probably have a couple dozen contractors who grow plants, including people at the community farm and elsewhere around the area. They get plants from probably at least the four states in the driftless area, but even beyond that. And there are other people who gather seeds from them. I have an old friend who knows an awful lot about these things, and he gathers seeds from all over. He gets permission from people to come in at the time that the seeds are ripe and picks them and sells them to Prairie Moon. And you know, just a couple ounces of seeds can be worth a lot of money, but of course it's a lot of work. Yeah, they don't grow close together necessarily, so you have to know.
I was kind of intrigued by the seeds, the weight of seeds that, you know, there was one where took about 300 seeds of one plant to make an ounce, and something like 2 million seeds a different plant to make an ounce.
Oh, the facility is amazing now, considering they grew out of a little log cabin with an outhouse, basically. And now they have this big new buildings and greenhouses and so on. But when we were touring it, they said, now reach in and feel these seeds. And it was like feeling kind of gritty dust, basically. The seeds were so small. And then they have other seeds that are like bean seeds, you know, are so large.
Yeah, it's an interesting story for sure. You know, it was also really interesting to read about the Prairie Island Indian community. I knew nothing about it, and so it was a bit of a revelation to me. Talk about the history of the place.
Sure. Well, when the settlers first started to arrive in this area, the people who lived here were Ho-Chunk people and Dakota people. And they're kind of related. The languages are related and so on. And Prairie Island there's a number of islands called Prairie Island, but this is a large one just upstream from Red Wing. And that's where the community is now. They used to own a lot of the land in southeastern Minnesota and along the Mississippi River, too. But this community, as is true of pretty much all the Indian communities in the upper Midwest, or most of them anyway, were removed a lot. And they were moved, you know, they'd be moved 100 miles west, then another couple hundred miles west. Then a lot of them ended up in Oklahoma, and the treaties were ignored, and they were treated really, really miserably. And some of them, people would, they were so attached to their home, of course, that they would come back. And in the case of Prairie Island, some of the Dakota people, you know, left the reservations and came back, which was against the law, and settled in Prairie Island. So they kind of kept a presence there. And eventually they got reservation status. But unfortunately, they built two nuclear power. It's one nuclear power plant, but it's two nuclear reactors there at Prairie Island. So they have their community that's pretty much in the shadow of a nuclear power plant on a beautiful area of the river, and they have a large casino there now that was pretty successful. I know they've had a hard time with the pandemic, of course, and a resort, and they have a excursion boat that goes out on the Mississippi River, and the community is really kind of blossomed lately, in part with the help from the casino proceeds, but just because they've grown stronger, I think, and more cohesive. And they're actually getting some land off of Prairie Island, sort of in compensation for the fact that the nuclear power plant was built there. And when at the downstream end of the island is Lock and Dam 3, which flooded a lot of their land, including cemeteries. And so they're kind of on the rise now, and they have some land a little bit west of Prairie Island, and they're raising buffalo again, and they're consuming buffalo meat, and they're teaching the young people to speak the language, because for several generations, the young people would be taken from the families involuntarily and put in Indian schools where they it was against the rules to speak their native language. They had to speak English all the time, and the kids would be punished for speaking their native language. So there was a generation or two in a lot of the tribes that couldn't speak the language. So they're teaching the kids the language now, and they actually have online language lessons. So remote members of the tribe can learn the language. So it's a story that has a lot of sadness and a lot of, you know, a lot of terrible things happen, but there's a lot of positive things that are going on now. And it's always an interesting story for us to have in there. I liked it, and they've got a strong attachment to the river, of course, and to the Driftless area, because they've been here for many thousands of years.
Yeah, I've been here forever, essentially. Yeah. Reggie McLeod, our guest, he is editor of Big River Magazine, talking about life along the Mississippi. Questions for him, give a call at 800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our producer today, Christina Myshock, our engineer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. Talking today with Reggie McLeod, editor of Big River Magazine, taking a look at life along the Mississippi River with him. And I hope you'll join in with your questions and comments as we move along. Questions about what's going on over there, maybe a favorite a place that you want to talk about along the Mississippi, give a call, 800-642-1234, or email us to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Well, Jeff in Milwaukee has emailed a question that relates to one of your stories, actually. He wants to know if you could talk about the African-American settlers just west of Hillsboro. That's right in one of the stories you have in the magazine this month. And by the way, we're talking, it's the March-April edition, 2021.
Yeah, and I should note that we kind of have a focus to each issue. Not all the stories are on that focus, but for March, it's a history issue, and we wanted to usually do a couple of big history stories. And in this March-April issue, Sarah Melhouse wrote a story about black settlers in the Driftless area, and there were two principal communities in the Wisconsin Driftless area that was settled by black people from the South, actually, who came up here, but quite a few came up before the Civil War, and of course more came up after the Civil War. The one by Hillsboro was Cheyenne Valley, and the other one was Pleasant Ridge, which is down in, that's kind of down in Richland County, I believe.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was interesting to me because I had read about that. And when I first moved out here in the 70s, I could go to places like Coon Valley, Wisconsin, and be in the store, and I'd hear people speaking Norwegian still. I mean, they would do business in Norwegian in the stores, and I don't hear that anymore. But a lot of communities were mainly from one ethnic group. And having moved here from Milwaukee and grown up in the Detroit area, I thought, where are the black people? This is such a beautiful place, and there are all these different groups represented. And then I read a story in the Okooch Mountain News, which was an excellent newspaper that was published in Richland Center. And that was about the community in Cheyenne Valley. And I was really fascinated with that. And I've been thinking, you know, that was a long time ago that I read that. But I always wanted us to do an article about that. And Sarah Melhouse, who's on our staff, was also interested in that. She grew up in Galena, and there was another community down in Galena, too, that was established later called Equal Rights, Illinois. So, yeah, it was interesting to see this, but it's also kind of sad that those communities aren't here anymore. They were pretty successful communities, And a lot of people came out of those communities and were very successful in other places, but they didn't stick around. None of the original settlers are there. There are probably people in Madison whose ancestors lived in those communities, and so on. Some of the first integrated, I believe the first integrated school in Wisconsin was in Pleasant Ridge, Wisconsin. And they seemed to get along pretty well with the neighbors, but there were certainly problems. And, it's just interesting to see what happened. We really wanted to track down some of the descendants and talk to them in person, and we weren't able to do that. But it's interesting that they're gone. But then again, there are many communities where you'll see a sign for a community and there's just like two houses there now, you know. So a lot of small farming communities have gone away in this area, of course. But
well, you do write about some interesting people in there. In that article, I was taking a guy by the name of Romulus Richmond. He lived in Pleasant Prairie. I think he moved on to Iowa, but he invented a number of things, including a device for lowering caskets into the ground and a machine gun capable of firing 200 rounds per minute.
There were a number of interesting people that lived in there, and I think part of that was just the fact that they had such a broad experience, you know, having lived under slavery in the South and then moved up here and then, you know, becoming successful farmers. They had to be really smart and really motivated and work pretty hard to deal with all of that.
Yeah, for sure. Bob in Onalaska has a question for us, I believe. Bob, hi, thank you for calling.
Yes, I had a question in regards to Decorah Peak by Galesville. As a kid in Boy Scouts, we would hike up to the top of that, and then there was a story, and I don't know if it was a true story or not, but we heard a story about the Chief Decorah who retreated up to the top of this thing, and you can only get through there. There's a narrow passageway to get up to the top of the peak, and I was wondering if you could expand on that.
Well, that's one of my favorite spots, and I haven't been there for a while. It is on private land, so you have to be kind of, I don't even want to say it's okay to walk out there or not. You'd have to talk, you should talk to the landowner before you go there, but it's an incredible spot. It's a big column of stone that projects out of the top of a hill, and there's a crevice in the middle, so you crawl up the crevice in the middle and are on top of this platform, and you have an incredible 360-degree view of the Driftless area that extends for miles. I mean, you can see, I'll bet you can see at least 10 or 15 miles to the south towards La Crosse, and you can see the bluffs in Minnesota, the river bluffs, and you can see other bluffs nearby. It's an incredible place, and the story is, I think that's probably a true story. There was a Ho-Chunk settlement on the Black River near there, and some Indians that they were fighting with from the north, the Chippewa, had come down and attacked the village. And Chief Decorah climbed up through that crevice of the rock, and from there, he could defend himself because they could only crawl up through that crevice one at a time. So he kind of made a stand up there. And that ban was later removed from there, speaking of removing Indian bans, over to Iowa. There was like a no man's land. It was a terrible place to live. Kind of between, on the Iowa-Minnesota border, they called it the neutral territory, I think. And so the Dakota people were on the north side of that border, and their mortal enemies, the Sac and Fox, were south of that area. And they put the Ho-Chunk people in between, and Decorah, Iowa is named after Chief Decorah. And there's a lot of names along that area from the Ho-Chunk people, actually.
Interesting. Well, Bob, thank you very much for that question. Appreciate it. It was a, led to a nice story there. Thanks again. Vern and Nina, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Vern.
Happy St. Patrick's Day.
Oh,
yeah.
That's
over
yeah.
here. I never saw such big flakes in all my life.
Oh. Well, Aaron Gobrah. Yep.
Yeah.
I'm calling about, I really feel bad how the Indians were treated by our people. It's really a shame because, I mean, they were here first, and we just moved them around all over and just disrupted their life. And I'm an environmental person, and I really feel bad about, you know, not treating this land like it should be treated. But I was wondering, the Mississippi River intrigues me. Where does it actually start up north?
Well, it starts, and these things are always debatable, you know, a bit. But the accepted answer is Lake Itasca, which is in northern Minnesota. And there's a small lake that's attached to that, a little bit upstream called Elk Lake, that some people say it's Elk Lake. But that's where it starts. And it's actually in Minnesota for, boy, I should look it up before I say it, but it's a few hundred miles. I think it's like 300 miles or so. It's entirely in Minnesota. And most people think of the Mississippi River as being in Louisiana and Mississippi, of course. But I know the first time I saw it was by Prairie du Chien at Wild Lucene State Park. I saw it from the bluffs at night. I got up there to go camping with some of my friends when I lived in Milwaukee. And I said, "What river is that?" And they said, "Oh, that's the Mississippi." I said, "Don't tell me that. Mississippi River isn't in Wisconsin." And they said, "No, it is." And I thought they were pulling my leg. I had to go look at a map. So, yeah, it's a northern river, too. I mean, it's not too far from Canada where it starts, actually.
Yeah. There you go, Vern. Thank you so much for calling. And you can join in with your questions, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Give a call or email to ideas@wpr.org. Speaking of emails, Brian emailed to ask if there is any interest in replacing the term the driftless area with a term not based on a flawed geologic theory.
Oh, my goodness. There we go. That's even more controversial than the source of the Mississippi River. In fairness, during the last glacial period, there were no glaciers in the driftless area, and that includes the part of it in Minnesota, Iowa, and Illinois. But before that, glaciers that came here millions of years ago did actually cover the Minnesota part and I think the Iowa part too of what we call the drift, what we mistakenly call the driftless area. So you can qualify it and say in the last glacial era, which lasted, I can't tell you exactly how long it lasted, but it lasted up until like 24,000 years ago or 20,000 years ago. So that's good enough for me.
Okay. We'll go with that then. Brian, thanks for that email. Owen in Cornucopia emailed to ask if you're familiar with the fantastic David Rhodes novel, Driftless and Jewelweed. They are both, those are two books. They're both set in fictitious communities of that area and are deliciously steeped in local color. he says he has made was made aware of these novels on Chapter a Day. So the David Rhodes novels, Driftless and Jewelweed. Are you familiar?
I haven't read Jewelweed. I hadn't heard of that one. I'm writing it down as we speak. I heard Driftless on Chapter a Day, and then I read it. And it's fun, and it's fun because it really kind of, and I would say it is pretty colorful, but it captures a lot of the mood and the social structure of very small rural towns in the Driftless area, I think. And that's the only book I've read that really kind of handles it that way. You know, it's fun. It is fun, yeah. He's a good writer. And I'm going to find Jewelweed, too. Thank you for that tip. There's also a trilogy called The Driftless, not The Driftless Area, The Driftless Zone. Some people call it The Driftless Zone. And there's a writer who lived in La Crosse that wrote a trilogy, the first of which is called The Driftless Zone. Mm. And I can't remember his name right now, but if you Google Driftless Zone, you could find it out. And those pretty much happen right in La Crosse and in the La Crosse area. So it doesn't have the rural flavor and culture of Rhodes's Driftless book. But that's another set of fiction novels that was written in the Driftless area.
We let's turn back to the magazine for a bit because there were some other stories I did want to mention or talk about. And I like this story, and it's really a good time to be talking about them. Bumblebees, they're the first native bees to wake up in the spring. Maybe you could tell us about the queen and how she starts a new colony.
Yeah, that's really that's really fascinating because, I find bumblebees fascinating, as does Pam Iden, who wrote the story. In the spring, a lot of times you'll see, probably by April, you see a lone bumblebee just like searching and going along the foundation of your house or around the porch or maybe in the shrubbery, like it's looking for something. And that's a queen bumblebee who has hibernated through the winter and is looking for a place to build a nest. So she has to find a little, often it's just a little hole in the ground or in a foundation or something, and she'll build a small nest and start laying eggs and gathering pollen. And pretty soon, by the end of the summer, she's created a whole colony of maybe a few hundred bumblebees. And they're working and gathering food and raising new bumblebees. And there are drone bumblebees that are born late in the season and then in queens. And then the queens fly off and they mate with drones. And everybody but the queen dies in the winter. And those lone queens find a place to hibernate. And then the next spring it starts all over again. So
amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a lot of work for those queens. I mean, it's hard to imagine. But one of the reasons they get out so early is not only do they they're fuzzy, which kind of acts like a fur coat for them, but they also vibrate when they gather pollen, and that generates heat to keep them warm. But it also shakes the pollen loose, and it sticks to that fur on them. And so they're a very important pollinator for the early spring wildflowers. So they're a big, you know, everything is so connected in nature and so complex. But they're a really key ingredient for those a lot of those wildflowers that bloom early surviving, you know, into a new generation and being able to thrive.
And I was kind of interested to know that they actually package, that there's bumblebees packaged sort of like the honeybees.
Yeah. people are trying to encourage them. I mean, it's interesting now. And in the next issue, and I was just working on the story this morning, we're doing one on some people that raise monarchs to release them. And now people get bumblebees and raise them, and they're important for pollinating commercial crops as well as wildflowers, because, of course, they're working all year. They're out there pollinating right from the very first flowers that bloom till, you know, the first frosts start killing them off. So yeah, they're important very broadly.
Reggie McLeod, our guest today, and some callers online. You could join in 800-642-1234 or email us to ideas@wpr.org. Before we go back to the phones, I want to also mention fish jumping. I don't think many folks think about why fish jump, but you have a few suggestions in a story in the latest issue.
Yeah, and John Lyons, who works at UW-Madison, wrote that story, and he comes up with a lot of good ideas for fish stories, actually. And when you're fishing, or even if you're just out in the woods or boating or paddling around on a lake, it's always thrilling. At least I find it thrilling when I see fish jump. Now, there are situations like the silver carp jumping where they knock people out of boats and it's like popcorn on the water. I've never seen that. I've seen videos of that, but they're pretty common in some water farther south of here. But some fish, like the paddlefish, which is really an interesting fish, has a big snout like a paddle, they probably jump to shake lamprey eels off of them. The eels attach to them and feed on their fish fluids. And the impact of them hitting the water and shaking and all that shakes the eels off. And you can see that below the dam and Sauk Rapids on the Wisconsin River, or the Prairie du Sac Dam on the Wisconsin River. Carp, and I've seen carp, you can go in the backwaters of the Mississippi very, very early in the spring when it's really still pretty cold, and sometimes look out across a big backwater lake and you'll see carp just popping out of the water. It's really strange. And big, really big carp. And apparently they're doing that because when they're spawning, a lot of males will gather around a female while she's laying her eggs so they can fertilize the eggs. And if a carp can't get close to the action, they'll jump out of the water to jump over her other suitors to get closer in there. And that's why you see all these big carp leaping out of the backwaters. I was amazed by that because I've always just been fascinated by that. And I thought, why would they possibly do that? I've actually tried to catch them when I was fishing, and they have no interest, believe me, no interest in your bait or lures at that time of the year. And then, you know, other fish, of course, jump to catch food, you know, though, especially when I'm trout fishing. If you're out on a trout stream, sometimes they'll just come up and sip bugs out of the water that are hatching from the water, and they float up to the top, and then they crawl out of their shell and fly away, and the fish will just be kind of sipping them off the top of the water. But sometimes they'll leap out of the water to catch a fly or some bug that's airborne. And I've seen that with sometimes when I'm fishing in the backwaters, before my spinner will hit the water, and this is really fun, it'll be about a foot off the water, a big largemouth bass will come up to try to grab it right out of the water, which is just amazing.
It's really cool.
I've never had one, actually. I've never caught one that way, but I've seen them try really hard. And then little fish often jump when they're pursued. And you can track white bass and northern. Sometimes I've caught northern because I see a
muskies
bunch of
muskies, too.
Fish. Yeah. Yeah.
Muskies, too. I've caught some muskies that way by seeing an area where the little fish are jumping out of the water and moving around quick. And there I've had some success with catching muskies that way.
Yeah.
But Paul, that's a great, it's, and you didn't cover everything in the story. It's a great story. Paul in La Crosse has a question for you. Paul, hi.
Hi, this is about rattlesnakes. When I was a young kid, preteen, my next-door neighbor, Mr. Rumsey, was a rattlesnake catcher for the bounty they had on him then. And apparently, if you had a rattlesnake with young that hadn't been born yet, he would keep them. And some of his rattlesnakes ended up next to my parents' garage in a chicken wire cage. And he would get more money for the young than just a pregnant rattlesnake. And I wondered what you had to say about rattlesnakes and bounties.
I'm very fond of rattlesnakes, actually. And the bounties went off of them decades ago. I think Wisconsin was one of the earlier states to do that. And I think all of them followed it after that. I knew someone in Houston County, Minnesota, which borders the river in Iowa, who started rattlesnake hunting when he was a kid. And he would sometimes get more than 100 rattlesnakes in one day, which is amazing, but it's also kind of gruesome. Because they're an important species. But later on, I did a story on him at one point, and we went out and found some rattlesnakes, and he poked at them and that. And he reached a point in his life where he stopped killing them, and this is when there was still a bounty on them. He came to appreciate them and value them. And when I was working on that story, actually, we came back down off the hill, and there was a farmer out there haying, and he told me, now, I'm going to talk to the farmer and tell him I killed a bunch of snakes up there, and just don't say anything. Because I'm going to lie and don't say anything. And so, because he gave us permission to go up there. So it's good they've taken the bounty off them. They are very attached to a specific place where they hibernate, you know, usually a small cave. And if you kill all the rattlesnakes in that cave, and they hibernate with other types of snakes, non-poisonous snakes too, if you kill all the rattlesnakes in that cave, it'll be empty. I mean, that colony is gone. You've basically destroyed the colony. And that's one of the sad things about them. They're not a real flexible species. You know, it's not like another one is going to come in there and settle in there and start another colony. We're lucky to have them. And there are still places where there are a lot of them. I see them from time to time, and I see some pretty large ones sometimes. So they're still here.
Well, on that note, we are out of time, Reggie. Boy, this has been fun. This magazine is filled with some great stories, and I think to order copies, bigrivermagazine.com, right?
Yeah.
And that's where you...
Yeah. Or they can call 1-800-303-8201.
1-800, what was it again? 1-800-303-8201. Reggie, it's always fun. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, I always have a lot of fun. Thank you, Larry.
Reggie McLeod, editor of Big River Magazine. Take a look at it. It's full of great stories, and I enjoyed talking with him. And I know I'm going to enjoy talking to my next two guests as well, because they are both with the International Crane Foundation. We'll find out some more in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.